BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
One dull December weekend in the 1960s, with my parents out of earshot and my ancient Nana dozing in her chair, I crept into Mum and Dad's bedroom, navigated the creaking floorboard, and conducted a rapid, heart-pounding search. Inside the wardrobe, under the bed, where had they hidden the mysterious box? I found it, and I still remember my uneasy mix of delight and dismay. I'd ruined the Christmas Day surprise, and I would have to feign amazement when I unwrapped the gift, which could be a challenge because Mum and Dad knew about acting and my performance would be bad. Worst of all, though, I'd ousted a secret. The box contained a magic set. At the time, they were all the rage. Inside were compartments containing the different tricks. Doctored playing cards, plastic cups and balls, dice, a length of special rope, and a magician's wand with a concealed piece of thin black elastic that could be stretched from its tip and held invisibly so you could make the wand extend supernaturally from your grasp. For several months I practiced my fledgling magician skills, sat very close to our black and white TV when the magician David Nixon was on, and perfected step one of the cup and ball trick. One day I borrowed Mum's showbiz top hat and a silky scarf, and took my guinea pig Penny from her cage. Magicking animals from hats wasn't in the instruction book, but I gave it a go. Penny was singularly unimpressed. She did a poo in the hat and refused to disappear. Abracadabra. David Nixon was hugely popular on TV at this time. He'd apparently started performing after an aunt had bought him a magic set for Christmas. This was encouraging to know. He'd joined the Magic Circle in 1938, was in ENSA during the war, then a touring variety troupe based in Scarborough, conjuring and being a rather suave compere. As with so many stars who began in variety and review shows, TV gave Nixon his big break. I liked his bald head and his genteel charm. Not too posh, but posh enough to be somehow reassuring. I must confess, though, I soon got bored with my magic set, and even with David Nixon. I was, if you like, disillusioned. My magic set instructions had exposed a trickery, and that brought with it disappointment. It dawned on me that the secrets held by the professionals were really no different, just harder to grasp. David Nixon was a liar. All those magic variety acts were a clever con. Magic tricks weren't proper magic at all. Of course, I knew that some acts were illusions. I knew those women weren't really being sawn in half, though I worried that the blade might slip, and I still don't quite know how it's done, even though I've been there. Once, during a comedy magic show on the Edinburgh Fringe, I was dragged from the audience and sawn in half with an electric chainsaw. I'm still, broadly speaking, intact, but I've never sat in a front row since. These days, as a writer, I'm in the business of truth and lies, and I guess of what Coleridge coined the willing suspension of disbelief. Not unlike our experience of a compelling piece of fiction, a magician's audience buys into this willing suspension. We at once believe and don't believe. And perhaps the connection between stage magic and art goes beyond the artistry of the magician and is something to do with the function of art in our lives. In his foreword to Magic Show, a Haywood Gallery touring exhibition, Roger Malbert writes of how both magicians and artists are in the business of mystification and manipulation. And he goes on to say, "This is not for entertainment, but to reveal something about the fundamental relationship between matter and the mind. How far can the wish for change overcome the inertia of the material world, which so often defeats us and resists our interventions?" Yeah, overcoming the inertia of the material world. Perhaps both imaginative writing and magic tricks make the unchangeable change, the impossible possible, the immovable move. And that's something that both delights and scares me. The thrill of anything is possible versus the terror of, so therefore nothing is certain or safe. At least when I write, I'm kind of in control of that mutability, whereas in life or in magic, I'm not. Stage magicians are often described as performing secular magic, not to confuse it with something that calls on spiritual or demonic forces, miraculous occurrences that can never be explained. As a child, I was terrified of poltergeists and of the idea of a person having powers to make things move, shapeshift, or disappear. The ability for someone to get into my mind and read it. Terrified, but also fascinated. I kind of wanted those moments when the solidity of a reassuringly logical, scientific narrative of the world falls away and we enter a state of bewilderment. I wanted existential enigma. I wanted magic to be magic with a K on the end. Perhaps when I write, I want my fictions to be mysteriously true. "How on earth did he do that?" Mum asked the TV. But she wouldn't have watched David Nixon again if she'd found out. And of course, magicians don't want us to know. Keeping the secret. Wondering, believing and imagining. A freewheeling fantasy of what might have been in the box-shaped parcel my parents had smuggled into the house that December day would always have been more exciting than the reality of my magic set, nice as it was. In our current age of political misinformation, misdirection and fiction presented as truth, we perhaps understand better than ever both how suggestible we can be, how a combination of belief and trickery can form compelling narratives, and how something fundamental in our sense of ourselves in the world falls into crisis when we lose faith or know we've been deceived. And misdirection, more than speed or sleight of hand, has always been a key tool in the magician's kit. As Matthew Tompkins writes in The Spectacle of Illusion, magicians have long known, and scientists are becoming increasingly aware, that misdirection can encompass much more than simply influencing where a spectator looks. Used effectively, misdirection can affect not just what we see, but how we reason and remember. Or, in the words of Faye Presto, magic is not about tricks, it's about people. Presto, who was born Oliver Winter in 1948, is best known for kick-starting the popularity of close-up magic. And I discovered recently that she was one of the first women to be granted entry to the magic circle, and this only happened in 1991. Even then, 25% of the male members, I use those words carefully, voted against this change in the rules. In Michael Kilgariff's Grace, Beauty and Banjos, which lists variety and musical artists, 115 magicians are named, but only 9 of them are women, and of those, most are wives of a more famous bloke. One of those husband and wife duos, the Piddingtons, were known for their telepathy acts on variety stages, radio and later TV. One of their displays of apparent telepathy was the diving bell experiment, in which Leslie was submerged in a swimming pool whilst husband Sidney sat in a BBC studio and allegedly communicated with her telepathically. I won't even speculate why she was the one in the pool. What I want to think about here is how they always close their act by saying, "Telepathy or not telepathy, you are the judge." Tantalising. And a kind of get-out clause. Telepathy and other variants of psychic stage act perhaps sit in our imagination somewhere between magic with a K and illusion. Hypnotism, likewise, though it also has a long history of uses in both psychology and medicine. The art of inducing trance states is ancient, but hypnotism as we now know it actually began when in 1842 a Scottish surgeon, James Braid, created the term from the Greek word hypno, meaning sleep. And today, the UK gastroenterologist Peter Warwell is known internationally for his pioneering use of hypnotherapy in the treatments of patients with gut disorders. A number of stage hypnotists have also had parallel or prior careers in the world of medical hypnosis, including David Berglas, who appeared in variety theatre all over the place and created in the 1950s what's still referred to as the Holy Grail of card magic, the Berglas effect. But he had initially studied psychotherapy, specialising in medical hypnosis, and went on to develop a fantastically successful stage hypnotism career. The collision of the worlds of medicine, psychology and showbiz perhaps explains my particular fascination and confusion over what I'm watching when I see a stage hypnotist at work. And I'm rather relieved when illusionist and mentalist Derren Brown not only denies that his acts are supernatural, but goes out of his way to expose the methods of anyone who claims to have special powers. He asserts that he's all about misdirection, psychology, and showmanship, and often begins his acts by saying as much. Perhaps he needs to. What had been a massively popular form of entertainment, with its heyday in musical, fell into disrepute during the 20th century. And in 1952, the Hypnotism Act was brought into force, designed to protect the public from unscrupulous performers and addressing a concern that hypnotism could be dangerous. Perhaps this was partly because of Peter Casson. "Peter Casson makes your wildest dreams come true," reads the bill for a variety show at Leeds Empire. Like David Berglas, Casson's interest in hypnosis had stemmed from a study of psychology and therapy. But his independent newspaper obituary tells of the occasion when the BBC tried to film his stage act and he inadvertently hypnotised several engineers watching on monitors from the control booth. Anxious that Casson would have viewers all over the country falling into trance states, the filming was abandoned. His obituary ends, "Anyone lucky enough to see him would come away with a deeper appreciation of the uncanny potential of the human mind." Uncanny. I've recently been invited to undergo medical hypnosis, and my anxiety levels are rather high. What if I go under? What might I do or say? What if I'm taken so far out of myself that I never quite come back again? I don't really believe that that will happen, and I'm sure Peter Warwell would tell me hypnotism doesn't work quite like that. But I'm thinking of my mum and dad recommending, "Go to the theatre, see a show, it'll take you out of yourself." And of how a song or dance routine can transport us, entrance us, conjure a memory, change our mood or mind. How acrobats, illusionists and mesmerists can induce in us a blurring of amusement, thrill, escapism and fear. How entertainment takes us out of ourselves. And I guess that's what it is. A world that takes us out of ourselves. And for me, one that's helped formulate my understanding of my upbringing. Helped shape my attitudes to animals, politics, my feminism, humour, love of music and my desire for magic. The attraction of taking both myself and an audience out of ourselves is perhaps what's made me the kind of writer I am today. Entertainment. I've hardly touched on it, but it's time to go. The stage is revolving, and all the performers are there. There's Gracie Fields, Peter Casson, Tessie O'Shea. There's Ella Shields, Arthur Worsley, David Rosaire, Tina Painola. There's Wilson, Keppel and Betty. There's the Piddingtons, the Tiller Girls, Waldini's Gypsy Band. A cat is weaving its way across the stage. And look, there's Mum and Dad. Everyone's waving.